of the media, civil society, welcome to the Bloemfontein Region Police on this Friday. Just to indicate to members that we will try and finish here at 12:20 in terms of our time. Maybe just one or two changes to our program for next week. Members will remember that we're supposed to have a briefing from IPET on Wednesday, but we will on Wednesday at 9 o'clock start with final deliberations and adoption of the Route 201 report. So Wednesday, the report is ready, and we will then table it on Wednesday for discussion option, and so that will be from about 9 o'clock until 11:30. And then from 11:30 to about 1 o'clock, we will have the Minister of Police briefing us on the reference group. So the IP hearing, we will just shift that to a later date that we conclude on the 201. There's a slight possibility to also meet next Friday on in terms of processing our reports, because we lost some time on Wednesday. Our briefing and interaction with SAPS went beyond the normal time, and we had to shift the briefing from Honourable Bailey to today, so we're also a bit behind. And then the last week, that is committee week, we will also maybe need an additional day. Colleagues will remember that we have a briefing to come from South African Police Service, Sun Parks, as well as the NPA, flowing from our visit to Kruger in February. So we will need a whole morning for that, so that will move to the last week of Parliament, the Tuesday. So I just want to give members an indication, but we will also update the Z list this morning and also ensure that there is communication of the information. Thank you very much. Members, our program for today, we will have first a briefing from Parliament on the issue of this bills, the process, how does it work, what is our role, and then we will give an opportunity to Honourable Bailey to brief the committee, and then we'll have initial interactions. If we've got enough time after that, we will go to the reports, the minutes, but if we don't, of course, that will stand over. So members, that's our program. Welcome to Ms. Desreswas of Parliament's Legal Division. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. As Chairperson mentioned, I'm from Legal Services. I'm from the Legislative Staffing Unit within Legal Services. Our role in the Legislative Staffing Unit is to assist committees for committee bills, the drafting thereof, as well as we assist private members who want to introduce bill to make sure that it complies with constitutional standards, as well as that past legislative drafting practices. My interaction with this bill is exactly that. We assisted the member with the drafting thereof to make sure that it complies with the format of bill, as well as we look at constitutional issues. However, the policy stance and the motivation for the bill, that is for the member to present to the committee. We will also assist the committee with issues the committee proceed with any legal amendments to the bill, as well as any advice that the committee may request on the processing as well as the content of the bill. That's just a brief history of me. The reason why I've put it, gone into detail about the history of the bill is because of my understanding that this is the first time this committee, which is the PC committee in the first parliament, is processing a private means bill. So I thought I'd go into where the bill has come from, the process it has followed up until now, as well as the second part of it would be how the committee, now since the bill is before the committee, how the committee should process the bill. So just briefly, the private members bills and introduction thereof is regulated by the interim measures for introduction and consideration of private members bills. This was a decision taken by the House, and it was tabled in the ATC of 20 November. This was after the Constitutional Court declared the previous rules that related to the processing of private members' bills unconstitutional. So the rules that that I'm going to discuss is currently in this book. The 8th edition of the rules of the National Assembly. However, it doesn't have a number because it is intermediate. Now, the authority to introduce the bill, basically it stems from the Constitution. And the rules repeat this authority by saying that a member of the National Assembly can introduce any bill, except for two types of bills. So one is money bills, that can only be introduced by a Minister of Finance, and also Section 214 bills. Those are the bills that relate to the equitable share and allocation of revenue. Other than that, a member can introduce any bill in the National Assembly. However, the rules does place a limitation on a member that the member may not introduce a bill substantial of the same matter in the same annual session. So that's the only limitation which is placed. The pre-introduction stage requires the member to conform with the requirements set up in Rule 237. That rule relates to the format of the bill. It says that it must have an object, must have what the bill, the draft should look at, as well as Rule 241 that requires a publication requirement. And if it is a bill that deals with amending the Constitution, it is an additional requirement which is placed on the member. So the member must publish the bill, an explanatory summary of the bill, if he doesn't have a bill, or if there is a bill, which he intends to introduce in the government committee. The publication may contain an invitation to the public to comment on the bill, and those comments will then be submitted to the Secretary of Parliament. The Secretary of Parliament is also responsible for the cost of this, or Parliament is responsible for the cost of this publication. Once it comes past the introduction, the publication stage, at the introduction stage, a member must then produce a copy of the bill, or the bill has to be introduced that was already published in the Gazette. He must give a copy of the explanatory summary of the bill, if it was not published, and as well as a support memorandum which must explain the objects of the bill, give an account of expected financial implications for the state, and state the proposed classification of the bill. The introduction of the bill will then be published in the ATC report, and then thereafter the bill is intended to have been read for the first time in the House. The bill is then thereafter referred together with all the relevant documentation to the committee to consider and then report back to the House. That is what has happened up until now. The bill is now before the committee, and the intermediaries require that the committee must at least provide reasonable notice to the member in charge of the bill before it considers the bill. And then it further says, after due deliberation at the committee, it must consider a motion of desirability on the subject matter of the bill. Now, the initial consideration of the private member's bill is intended to be only on principle or the subject of the bill. The motion of desirability is decided on this basis. The committee may, however, only consider the motion of desirability, in other words, whether to proceed with the bill, only after due deliberation. Now, the rule doesn't give us clear indication what is meant by due deliberation, but there is a number of practices from previous considerations of the bill, which I will now go further as to what has been done in the past when it's considered the desirability of the bill. First, it would be expected that committee allow the member responsible for the bill an opportunity to explain and motivate for the legislation. This could, for example, also include details of stakeholders that the committee has, that the member has consulted when he or she prepared the bill, a summary of any public responses of the bill that was published, as well as an explanation of any anticipated costs of the bill to the state. Best practice would require the committee to facilitate an engagement with the relevant department or agency on the need for and the practicality, the practicability of the bill. It might be that government intends introducing similar legislation in the future, or that the policy direction which is proposed in this bill may be very different from what is currently in government. So it would be very useful for the committee to have this before it considers on whether it is desirable to have a bill such as this. The committee can also decide whether to have public hearings for those who have already made submissions on the bill when it was published in the Government Gazette. This approach was followed by the Scholar Committee on TAFE when it considered the remote gambling bill, where it called for people that already made submissions to hear, to listen to their submissions before it decided on whether to proceed or vote on the desirability of the bill. It may also at the same time invite any other interested party to come and give a submission to the committee. Then I'm going further to give information on the previous rules. And I'm saying that further guidance can be taken from the previous rule that was declared unconstitutional, and my reason is the following. Even though it is conceded that the court did declare that rule 235A unconstitutional in the case of Orlando Ambrosini versus Sisulu MP Speaker of the National Assembly, but the court did not ever qualify its decision to declare it unconstitutional and said that rule 235A is received only because it is meaningless in the absence of Rule 235, to which it owes its existence. This must, however, not be understood as a pronouncement on the constitutional validity of it, for that issue did not arise. So it's my view that the court didn't want to go into that inquiry, didn't say that the factors that the previous rule's validity was unconstitutional. It's only declared unconstitutional court. It depended on the rules of 235. It therefore submitted that the guidance which is set out there can also be applied by the committee when it decides which factors to take into consideration on whether the bill is desirable or not. Rule 235A listed the following factors that have been taken into account in its consideration. The committee has to consider whether the bill goes firstly against the spirit, purpose and object of the Constitution, seeks to initiate legislation beyond the competence of the Assembly. Those may be instances where the legislation may deal with matters which is exclusively for provinces or municipalities. So that's the ground where the committee can consider. Whether the bill duplicate existing legislation or legislation awaiting consideration by the Assembly or Council, whether the bill in similar legislation soon to be introduced by the National Executive, whether the bill will result in a money bill, or whether the bill is frivolous or vexatious. So once the committee has considered all these factors, the committee would then be in a position to decide on whether the bill is desirable or not. And then the committee must vote on the desirability of the bill. Only once the committee has now voted on the desirability, it can either reject the motion or it can accept it. If the motion of desirability is rejected, the committee must immediately table its report in the House. If the motion of desirability is adopted, the committee can proceed to consider the details of the bill in the normal way. In other words, consider every clause and consider it like it is any other bill before, like it is a normal bill before the committee. And it may even go wider public consultation for more people to come and brief the committee on the bill. Once the committee has done that, it must report to the House on the bill, and then it is placed on the order paper for a second reading. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Quartz, for the briefing. I will allow now members for questions, for clarity. Honourable Molobasi.
Yeah, thank you, Justice. In your motion of desirability, do you consider things like if that particular committee has already a bill in the pipeline or it is not taken into account? Second one is, who does the costing Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions for clarity? Honourable McClung, Honourable Margate.
My question on the question of desirability. What will be the factors that will actually then govern desirability aspect in order to avoid unnecessary politicking? I'm talking here about the tangible legal yardstick that can actually then determine whether it is desirable or not desirable, away from political assertions of things.
Thank you. Honourable Marquis, third question.
Thank you, Dr. Sen. Two things here, or maybe one. The desirability, if I understood it very well, the desirability of the subject that the bill is talking about, and the desirability in terms of what you just stated there. So are they equally important, or does it mean that if one of those mentioned under desirability is rejected, then it means the whole bill falls off? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Any other questions? Right, thank you very much. Ms. Watts.
Thank you, Chief. The list of things which is listed here, as I said, it's very little guidance in the current rules. These are things, it can be any one of those, it can be a group of those that can be put together to decide whether to have them or not. The subject matter is basically to say, it is in the interest that we have such a bill at this stage. However, the practicalities that we leave for later, because we can improve on the bill. But for now, we need a bill such as this. On the issue of whether there is such a bill in the pipeline, yes, that definitely is something that can determine whether a bill is desirable or not. It is no question that the departments are more suitable to they have more knowledge in how the bill will fit into the administration and what they can work with. We must have legislation which fits within the rest of the department's work, the department's working. So yes, the fact that the department may bring one soon is an issue that the committee can consider as to whether it wants the bill at this stage or not. But at the end of the day, it's not the committee as a whole to decide whether this bill is, whether they want this bill at this stage. On the issue of costing, on a private member's bill, that responsibility rests on the member to come and say, this is what I think the bill will cost. But the most suitable the department would be in a better position to say this is how such a bill will cost, will affect our budget. And it is an important factor for the committee to consider when it does consider the bill. I hope I answered all of them. I'd like to club some of them together, at least I've missed something.
Well, Bailey, next question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I just get legal clarity, because I'll concede that I'm not a legal mind, but legal clarity from Ms. Swartz on the status and substantive meaning of Rule 35A derived from the fact that Rule 235 in its entirety was declared invalid. What's the clear legal meaning of that rule having been severed? Because that's something that I think is also quite an important pivot. If it's severed, does that mean it's neutralized artifacts or suspended? Can you just get bit more clarity and detail on that severing of the sub-rule that derives from the one that was declared invalid.
Thank you. Any other member? Honourable Ramita Karnik.
Just just a quick one, a small question. Is it correct for my understanding or for me to say that a bill that is introduced, it's most case or in general cases follows the or legal lines sort out the root causes identified in the policy process. In other words, the bill is an expression, it's a legal expression of a policy that you want to address certain things. So it's derived from the policy. It's just want to get that it's correct for my understanding if I say so.
I just have all the questions from the members. Thank you. Just once.
Thank you. On the first question, yes, would it say severed in its entirety, it means that that rule was declared unconstitutional. It's no longer on the rule books, and that's why the second oath. However, the court did qualify and say, I didn't get arguments before me to say that this, well, that the factors listed here is unconstitutional, people don't need to consider it. The only reason why I am saying it is because if I leave that rule there to stand on its own, it's not going to have any effect because the other rules which is connected to it, in other words, for this rule to work, it's dependent on the rule 235. So for rule 235A to work, it needs to certify rule 235. So because of that reason, I'm saying, yes, this is also unconstitutional because it's not going to have any meaning because other rules is no longer there. So what I'm saying is, yes, the court did declare it unconstitutional. However, the fact that they can still be used as a guidance by the committee as to what it should take into account. I'm not saying that the court didn't have the fact that necessarily it's unconstitutional. It's only the court, it owes its existence from Rule 235.
On the same matter, a little bit.
It's a very small question because I think the semantics need significance. So with the line of logic, which I understand and I agree with, I guess the most simple way I can ask the question is, are the factors that hinge on that line of logic in effect? Are they, do they have legal force?
That's for this committee to decide. At the moment, it's guidance, it's not rules, it's not set out in the rules, it's guidance which the committee can decide as this, the things that we got to take into consideration. The current rules before the committee is there, it's got very little guidance, it just says the motion of desirability of the due consideration. It doesn't tell the committee what it should take into consideration. So if the committee decides these are the factors that we want to include in our due deliberation, the factors that we are going to consider will be for the committee to decide. But now it's not in the rule book at the moment. But the committee has had liberty to decide where it wants to take into it into account. On the second question, whether the bill legalized policy, yes, that is in fact true. The policy itself isn't would have been informed by the member, and that's the policy stance you would want to take, and then you would translate it into the bill, which is the bill before the committee.
Thank you, members. Thank you very much, Ms. Hutz, for your contribution. Honourable Rene, you are welcome to introduce the bill. Final, would you just want to assist the honourable member?
thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the members for their patience while set up. By way of finality, good morning, San Bonani. I'm going to be presenting on the private medical, the particular critical infrastructure bill. It's about 21 slides, so at a minute a slide, it should take about 20 minutes to get through all of that. So, how do I go forward? Alright, so looking at the objects of the bill, the first is to repeal the National Teapot Act of 1980 and related legislation. It is to provide for a register that would contain the areas declared as critical infrastructure, what's known as the key points under the current legislation, as well as to set out the rights and duties of owners of such critical infrastructure, provide for the limitation of the liability of the states, as well as provide for parliamentary oversights of the board that would be the central mechanism in the implementation of both. Further objects are to provide for the establishment, composition, functions, duties and meetings, financing and reporting of such a board, and then to provide for the suspension and removal of members of that board, critically to provide for the determination and declaration of critical infrastructure, as well as to ensure that security measures are implemented such declared infrastructure, and then finally create offences and penalties, as well as to provide more transitional arrangements following the repeal of the National Key Point Act. Just by way of giving historical context of the bill, of the act that is proposed to be repealed, this act, as we know, was enacted in 1980 by the Apartheid government in response to what it characterized as acts of sabotage and terrorism. And it was subsequently used as a tool of oppression because by design, the act was intended to protect and strengthen the apartheid states and gave the then apartheid era Minister of Defense very broad authority to declare any place in the country as a national key point. Thus this responsibility is currently vested in the Minister of Police. Very worryingly, the Act grants quite wide and far-reaching powers to the Minister of Police without scrutiny, and we would be aware of the legal battles and other tension that has happened in recent years around enabling access to information in relation to this. And therefore, I think there's a very clear basis on which to say that the current Act is at odds with the values of open and transparent governance which underpin the Constitution. Continuing to make arguments flowing from the historical context of the Act, given its nature and its underpinnings, there is a need for the repeal of the entire Act because it has no place in a constitutional democratic state. And in fact should not have been permitted to exist on the statute books for this long. And it is unfortunate that there was rarely any mention or interrogation of the Act having legal force for probably the first 15 years or so since democracy. Also important to note that the desirability of such legislative reform was previously indicated by former Police Minister Nathan Tefa, who towards the end of 2013 had initiated a review process in this regard, but we are yet to see the outcome of that, and such a delay does need to be urgently addressed. Thus, the presently proposed bill seeks to protect infrastructure that are critical to the national security of the Republic, but in a manner that would be consistent with the Constitution in an open and transparent society. Looking at sort of drilling deeper into the problems and defects with that currently in force, Presently, that Act has permitted that environments where critical infrastructure and related installations can be used to benefit or protect partisan agendas and conduct concealed corrupt activity under the guise of national security considerations. And the worst part of it is that it's actually very hard to determine the clarity on what has and has not been done or with what motive, because of the way that it makes accessing that information difficult. I would be remiss not to make reference to this, which is that the matter of security upgrades at the prisoner's private home in Gandra, insofar as it relates to the application of the Acts, provides the more compelling case study to illustrate how the provisions of the National Keyboard Act may be used unjustly to justify the burial of information and to frustrate overnight. So to sketch out the broad conceptual framework that this all rests on, of course it must be conceded that, as is the case in any states, there will always be a reasonable need to classify some information relating to key installations or facilities for security purposes or with the view of preserving the public interest. But as the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference stated in 2013, this does invite us to ask two questions. Firstly, how does one reasonably balance the need for security with the public's rights to information? And I would add to this that there's a need for transparent governance to be taken into consideration. And secondly, what happens when the authorities use their powers in terms of such legislation for ulterior motives? So moving on to outlining the features of the bill itself. The first key point, as I indicated earlier, is the central mechanism in this whole framework, which is the critical infrastructure board that would be created by this. So the bill looks to establish a board to oversee, determine, and declare the functions surrounding the protection and classification of critical infrastructure installations, as opposed to the police minister having sole discretion to declare which areas or structures need government protection. And in making that determination, as would be the function of the board, a site would have to fall into one of several categories in order to be considered as critical infrastructure. And this is contained in Clause 13 of the bill, having been developed after consulting international best practice in terms of this kind of legislation. So just to label that very quickly for 5 points. Areas used for the storage and development of chemical or biological warfare agents and defense capabilities against defense of such weapons of mass destruction would obviously need to fall within this. Secondly, facilities associated with computing, telecommunications, and information technologies. Emergency-related medical, police, fire, and rescue systems. Energy-related facilities and infrastructure. Financial services. Health services. Yeah. So that's the outlines in Clause 13. So as part of the process of determining what is eligible to be critical infrastructure, once a site has been determined as falling within a relevant category for consideration as critical infrastructure, which is phase one, the next thing is that the vulnerability of the sites must be determined, considering available intelligence and the consequences to national security in the event that such a place or area were to be compromised. Upon proper consideration of these factors in that two-step process, the board would then declare a place or area as critical infrastructure and would determine the appropriate security measures that must be in place at the specified place or area. And the nature of the input that would go into determining the appropriate measures would be covered by the proposed composition of the board, which is detailed in the bill, including experts from various relevant sectors.
The board would also be charged with reviewing critical infrastructure each financial year to prevent critical infrastructure receiving security measures and status, which are no longer required as time goes by. Onto the aspects of the bill that makes provision for parliamentary oversight, which is currently a very big glaring defect in the current National Key Point Act. So Chapter 6 of the bill allows for much needed parliamentary oversight to counteract the allocated executive power that's contained in the current National Key Point Act. The bill requires that two types of reports be tabled by the Minister of Police to the National Assembly. The first one would be an unclassified report. So the Minister would be required to table to Parliament on a quarterly basis an unclassified report outlining, firstly, the total number of existing critical infrastructure, secondly, the name of each critical infrastructure, thirdly, the details of whether each critical infrastructure is state-owned or privately-owned, and where applicable, which ministry is responsible for its management. And lastly, the name of any new critical infrastructure determined in the review period. The second type of report, as part of the parliamentary oversight framework, would then be a classified report. So in addition, the bill would require that a substantially more detailed report be made available to a closed meeting of this committee on all activities performed in terms of acts in the area, the iteration and dissemination of each critical infrastructure, so that the committee would have insights into the or at least have the opportunity to gain clearer insights into how each critical infrastructure has been determined and declared, if there are any questions that need to be asked. Secondly, allocation and expenditure of funds in the fulfillment of the functions under this Act. The determination of specific security measures for each critical infrastructure, the implementation of security measures at each facility or installation to ensure that things are in fact up to scratch, the number of security officers deployed to each critical infrastructure, the status of reviews conducted by the board in terms of the vulnerability and security measures taken at the critical infrastructure sites, the status of owner submissions made in terms of Section Clause 14.1 in determining those security measures, because there is provision made in the bill that should the owner of a critical infrastructure that is declared as such wishes to take on the financial costs of implementing such measures, they are able to do so, as well as reporting on any delegation of any of the board's powers. Okay, and so the concluding point to be made in terms of this reporting is that the requirements of these two lists that seeks to strike a balance between respecting the public rights of access to information on a general level in this arena, ensuring parliamentary oversight, as well as preserving reasonable security measures at critical infrastructure sites. The other key mechanism in terms of this bill would be the register, which clause 16 of the bill requires the board to maintain on a comprehensive and up-to-date basis. This register will allow for various specified persons who are outlined as being members of the board itself, members of this committee, and persons possessing the relevant security clearance and or permission of the board to have access to various details pertaining to critical infrastructure, including reasonably classified information. And the precise shape and contours of the information contained in the register beyond what is outlined in the bill would be determined through regulations that can be drawn up by the ministry. Continuing on the point of regulations, the bill also does seek to introduce
changes to the way that regulations are formulated by the Ministry in relation to critical infrastructure. By way of background, it's worth pointing out that in recent years there has been a tendency in bills that are passed to grant attested regulatory powers to ministers to implement regulations which in fact have significant and far-reaching consequences for the implementation of legislation which has been noted and pointed out as a concern. And the current National Key Points Act suffers from this defect, which is a problem because it means that you can have lawmaking by executive fiat, and that comes very close to degrading the separation of powers that is central to the setup of our constitutional state. So I would submit that such a practice does in fact weaken Parliament's oversight function and undermines its constitutional mandates. It also goes against the rule of law, which requires that the law be certain and the exercise of powers and discretions under the law not be taken in an unrestricted manner. Therefore, Clause 21 of the Bill marks a break with this practice by requiring that the formulation of regulations be a consultative process between the Minister and the National Assembly. And this not only encourages a transparent process in the formulation of the specified regulations, but also strengthens Parliament's position as a legislative and oversight body. So following such a consultative process, regulations made in terms of this bill would have to be tabled before Parliament 30 days before they are published for the committee's consideration. The bill also makes provision for transitional arrangements because it would take some time to move completely from the current regime to the new one proposed in the bill. So Clause 22 addresses this requirement by preserving the security of existing national key points for a defined period to ensure that they are given ongoing appropriate protection. In addition, any proclamation, regulation, notice, approval, authority, license, permit, certificates or documents issued, made, given or granted in terms of the current acts would be deemed to maintain their status under this provision for that limited time period. And so the Minister would be required to deliver a list of the national key points to the Board within 5 days of it being fully appointed so that the Board may within 275 days, that's the defined period, determine which of those national key points meet the requirements of critical infrastructure in order for them to be integrated into the new regime and implementation going forward. So in conclusion, sorry, my point is jumping around here. Yeah. I'm going to start by saying that the Ministry of Police has been aware of the need for such legislative reform for approximately 2 years with reference to the former police minister, Nadine Tetwa's pronouncements and commitments toward the end of 2013. And in his one speech to Parliament in May this year, the minister said, "One of the milestones registered thus far is the National Critical Infrastructure Bill, a piece of legislation that seeks to repeal the National Key Points Act, which is currently with Cabinet. But unfortunately, by the introduction of this private member's bill in August, no meaningful progress has been made on the repeal of the National Key Points Act by the Executive. And given the substantive need for such repeal, and given Parliament's lawmaking mandates, it is something that must be moved forward on very rapidly. And so as conscientious legislators, it is incumbent of this committee, cognizant of its duty to ensure that our legal framework is in line with the spirit, values and prescripts of the Constitution, that acts to remedy the current situation regarding the National Key Points Act. And I would further submit that this bill is the first step towards building, towards fulfilling that duty and I would invite both this committee and the ministry to use this opportunity provided by the bill to engage in a substantive consultative process of repealing the National Keyhole Tax and instilling security legislation which speaks to our nation's constitutional ideals. Thank you very much, Chairperson. That's the end of it.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bailey. We can just take a 5-minute coffee break because the members, you know, it's going to distract us when we go to questions. So, please.